From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday, the G8 leaders stood united in front of the cameras, pledging to advance counter-terrorism cooperation after the devastating attacks in London. But that doesn't mean intelligence and security efforts have ever or will ever flow seamlessly across borders. Tonight on Point, tracking down the terrorists. What's working, what's not, and the successes and failures of global cooperation. But first, we return to London. The confirmed death toll has climbed to at least 50 as investigators try to piece together clues from yesterday's terrorist attacks. While forensic experts search through the rubble, Londoners left bouquets of flowers and teary messages at subway entrances. Rob Watson is defense and security correspondent for the BBC. I asked him if all of the dead have yet been pulled from the wreckage of Thursday's attacks.
No, they haven't, and a search operation is still going on about 100 feet underground. That is on the tube train, the underground train, where there was an explosion between the King's Cross station and the Russell Square station. That's on the Piccadilly line, and of course it's one of the deepest lines in London. And another complication, of course, and any of your listeners who've travelled to London will know this, that those tunnels are so narrow and the blast was so intense that the police are saying that the tunnel isn't really safe and that they're worried about it collapsing.
We read the police chief, Ian Blair, describing the scene there in that deep tunnel, King's Cross, I guess, as one of extraordinary horror. How many bodies are still believed to be in the wreckage of that train?
They haven't said, and I'm not entirely sure that they know, but we know it's horrific from the accounts of the passengers who escaped. And of course, it's only now that some of those accounts are being told, and it is just horrendous. People talking about hearing the screams and of seeing body parts, that the lights going out so far below the ground, of having to walk along tracks, of seeing body parts. I mean, people have clearly been through an absolute nightmare down there.
Rob, tell us what the authorities are saying today of what they know about these attacks that we didn't know yesterday.
We still don't have the answers to the two key questions now. The two key questions are what exactly happened and who was responsible. What we do know from the police, what they are saying is that they now believe that there were four devices, that the devices were relatively small, about 10 pounds, big enough to be carried in a rucksack. They believe at least that on the underground trains, the three devices were on the floor. In other words, doesn't look like a suicide bombing. They seem to be a little bit less sure about on the bus. So that's where we are. We know a little bit about the size of the explosives. We had the head of the London police, Sir Ian Blair, saying that there was no evidence that he could see that there were suicide bombers, although he said he certainly couldn't rule it out. And interestingly, he said, so that leads you to one conclusion, and that is that the people responsible for this are either in the United Kingdom, overseas, or dead.
What about the type of explosives? Any links established to the kind of explosives we saw in Madrid or Istanbul?
No, and that, of course, is absolutely key. They haven't said if they do know what kind of explosives they are. They certainly haven't said so yet. And, of course, it is so important because quite often the kind of explosive that's been used would lead you to the kind of group that has used them in the past. So they haven't yet made that vital connection.
Any further reports on who's emerging as suspects or anything at all about the planning, the execution?
Not really, no. And what the police are saying, what the intelligence services are saying, is they're still operating under the assumption that this is the work of Islamic extremists. What they're not prepared to speculate about is what kind of Islamic extremist. Is it Al-Qaeda? Well, they say it has all the hallmarks of an Al-Qaeda attack. But again, that they're very mindful of what happened to the Spanish authorities after the Madrid bombing, saying this was the work of Basque separatists. Of course, in the end, it turned out to be Al-Qaeda. So they're very, very cautious. But the British intelligence services, they could be facing a number of potential problems here. One of their worst nightmares has long been this idea of people who were Islamic extremists but weren't necessarily members of a previously known group. Mm-hmm. People who had been inspired by the ideology and the methods of Osama bin Laden but hadn't necessarily been through that kind of classical Islamic extremist background of having trained in Afghanistan, being members of known organizations or visiting notorious mosques. And you can understand how that would be the worst nightmare of the police in London and indeed in other countries around the world, this idea of people out there who are just below the radar, but just as convinced ideologically as some of the other groups.
And these kind of spontaneous copycats, almost impossible to track, no linkages.
Well, exactly, that if all you had is that people have been inspired by Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, but they haven't actually had any links to his organization or haven't trained in any camps, then clearly from the point of view of the security services and the police, you've got a mountain to climb, because it could be just anybody out there. This could be, as the police have said, you're looking for a couple of evil needles in a very large haystack.
What about the scene in London today, the city's life? Is it returned to normal or still disrupted in the city centre?
Remarkably, it did look very normal, at least above the ground. And that, of course, is the strange thing. Above the ground, I noticed when I was leaving work, there were the people as normal on Fridays, sitting in the pubs. Everyone likes that in London on the rare occasions where the weather's good enough to sit outside. That the streets were busy. People were shopping in the main shopping districts. So above the ground, it looked kind of normal, but we know that below ground and in some of the underground stations that remain shut, that this massive, massive police investigation, intelligence investigation is underway, undoubtedly the biggest ever mounted by British security forces in peacetime.
What about the political impact of the bombing? It's early days yet, I know, Rob, but do you have a sense of how response to this is breaking out politically?
Well, you know, in the very few quiet moments that you get when a big story breaks like this on your patch, you don't get an awful lot of time for reflection. You're so busy reporting. But in the few minutes that I've had to think about it, you know, I think there are three possibilities. One that we journalists always kind of hate is that it might not have any effect at all. Mm-hmm. That is, that people will just carry on. This will be an obstacle in their lives. Their lives will flow around what happened, and that it won't change very much at all. The other possibility, of course, is that it rallies people around the government and to the idea that Tony Blair shares with President Bush, that the war on terrorism has to be fought and that there is a need to carry on with the mission in Iraq to try and export democracy to the Muslim world. But on the other hand, there may be the effect of those who say, look, you know, this just shows the dangers of being too close to the United States and of being involved with the United States in Afghanistan and Iraq.
That still to be clarified. We've seen both kinds of responses early today. Rob Watson in London, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Rob Watson is defense and security correspondent for the BBC. The smoke-filled train stations, the blasted bus, the 50 dead and 700 injured in London are stark reminders of terrorist determination. September 11th brought the international community together. This week, stunned G8 leaders in Scotland pledged again to step up united efforts to fight terrorism. Global measures, we are told, have thwarted many attacks. But the international community has not always worked smoothly together on this international problem. In June, an Italian judge ordered the arrest of 13 CIA agents on charges of kidnapping a terrorist suspect on Italian soil. Counterterrorism happens under a thick shroud of secrecy. Tonight, we'll pull that shroud back a bit to ask what's working and what's not. This hour, On Point, the global effort to track down terrorists. You can join the conversation. Are you confident the world is doing all it can to police the terror threat? Is international cooperation on tracking down terrorists more real or rhetoric? And beyond the photo ops at the G8 summit, do you trust the U.S. and Europe are fully cooperating? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Santa Monica, California, is David Aaron, director of RAND's Center for Middle East Public Policy. He's former deputy national security advisor to President Jimmy Carter. David Aaron, thank you for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me.
And with us from Washington is Julianne Smith, Deputy Director of the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Her expertise includes European security and defense and transatlantic relations. Julianne Smith, thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
David Aaron, to you first. Here we are, another attack, a big one in London. People still digging out there, describing scenes of absolute horror down in those tunnels. Yesterday, the concern was all right there in London. Today, of course, people thinking more and more about who did it, and how they might be apprehended, and how other attacks, future attacks, might be forestalled. What's your sense, as we sit here tonight, of how effectively the sort of international skein of police effort is knitted together in this effort to stop attacks like this, to track down who did it, to stop future attacks?
Well, I think it's quite a bit better than is going to be talked about in the next few days, particularly because we've had this terrible event. Mm. But defending yourself against terrorism is really very much like the old problems of defending yourself against bombers, air defense. You can exact a price, but you cannot protect everything, and there will be incidents. I think that right now, I'm sure that the British are getting full cooperation from all neighboring countries, including, of course, the United States and Canada, to try to track these people down and try to find out who may have left the country, where they might have gone if they did leave, all that sort of thing. It's not clear, of course. There's a suspicion that this may be homegrown, in the sense that these extremists actually live and reside in Great Britain. There's an old line about that among the intelligence and security people. They often refer to Great Britain, to its capital, as Londonistan, because it has had so many radical people preaching, attending mosques, and all the rest. But it's also equally possible that these people are from outside of Britain, that they've come because they're inside Europe someplace. And, of course, it's very easy to travel around Europe.
And we're going to look at exactly tonight at the efforts internationally to stop up this problem and to track down those who have committed this crime. Julianne Smith, please stand by. David Aaron, we're talking tonight about tracking down the terrorists, about what's working, what's not, and successes and failures in global cooperation. You can join us. Are you confident the world is doing all it can to police the terror threat? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about tracking down the terrorists, what's working and what's not. You can join the conversation tonight. Is international cooperation on tracking down terrorists more real or rhetoric when Italy is ordering arrest warrants for CIA agents for snatching suspects without permission? What does that tell you about cooperation? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined tonight from Santa Monica, California, by RAND's David Aaron, and from Washington, D.C., by Julianne Smith at the CSIS, the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Julianne Smith, what's your sense of what yesterday's attack in London will have, what kind of jolt it will have sent through global policing efforts? How does the U.K. respond? How does the international community respond to this kind of attack?
Well, I think it will add motivation to those focusing on the combat against terrorism and certainly trigger as some sort of shock in additional legislation. Perhaps we may see more resources and an improvement in capabilities. But ultimately, combating terrorism requires very much a multifaceted approach. You have to first, obviously, penetrate terrorist organizations. We are trying very hard to then arrest, capture, kill terrorist operatives. We're looking at the nexus between transnational crime and terrorism. We're trying to halt recruitment around the world in multiple countries, including inside Europe. We're all trying to integrate our Muslim minorities better in our societies here in the West. And we're looking at the roots abroad, taking a look at things like poverty and education, the role of radical Muslim NGOs in places like Southeast Asia or Pakistan. And I would say in that broad list of tasks that we have ahead of ourselves, we've done pretty well in the first three categories. By all estimates, we've eliminated anywhere from two-thirds to three-fourths of al-Qaeda leadership. We've clearly witnessed what's gone on from a military perspective in Afghanistan and Iraq, rooting out the Taliban there. But when it comes to really getting more at the roots, looking at radicalization, say, inside Europe, we've got a long way to go there, and I would give us lower marks. And so what I'm hoping is what we saw yesterday will trigger greater transatlantic cooperation in many of these key areas.
David Aaron, I wish you'd walk us through some of those same layers. How would you describe, sort of from the top level down to the most granular, paint a picture for us, from your perspective, Julianne's just given us the beginnings of one as well, of what the counter-terror effort looks like globally?
Well, there's two dimensions to it. One is the defensive, trying to find the terrorists and trying to protect yourself against them. The other is offensive, which is trying to take all those steps that you can to, as she said, cut the ground out from under them, somehow affect their recruitment efforts, their reconnaissance, and all that sort of thing. I would say that at the top level, there is a very strong commitment, which was manifested by the G8 leaders. And at the bottom level, the police, the security officers, the intelligence cooperation, and all the rest, that is going reasonably well, very well. But at the middle levels of government, for example, in Italy, which you've mentioned here, you have independent branches of government, for example, the judiciary. And their judiciary is a odd structure from our point of view because it has prosecutorial and investigative powers. And they're only interested in protecting the laws and so forth of the country. They don't really trouble themselves with questions of national security. And so they've now launched this thing which some might say was in some ways a publicity stunt, particularly since it's not going to have any practical value. Some say it's a political maneuver.
And this after the CIA apparently took a suspected Muslim radical actor out of Italy, reportedly to Egypt for interrogation.
Right. And, the government has said that it knows nothing about it. That is the administrative government. If I were them, I'd say the same thing.
David Aaron, Julianne Smith, please stand by. I want to welcome to our conversation from New York Ambassador Javier Ruperez. He is Executive Director of the United Nations Counterterrorism Executive Directorate. He's former Spanish Ambassador to the United States. Good evening, Ambassador Ruperez. Thank you for joining us.
Good evening. How are you doing?
We're doing well. We're looking at the real efforts on the ground to go after terrorists before attacks like what happened in London happen again. We've seen complaints from the head of counterterrorism in the European Union, saying that turf wars there are getting in the way of the most effective police action and intelligence sharing. And you have also spoken up, complaining that nations are not fully cooperating at the level of police cooperation, intelligence sharing, law enforcement, and best practices. I'm not sure the UN is at the center of this effort, but you do have a lot of experience in Spain with Madrid and everything else in terror, and you've got a central position for looking out on this picture. Do you see an adequate level of cooperation, Ambassador Ruperez?
Well, cooperation, international cooperation, is improving, but it is not quite enough, and this is something we have to realize. And unfortunately, we are seeing the results of that complete lack of cooperation every day. I wouldn't say that the case in London is precisely the result of the lack of international cooperation, because other factors involved. But certainly we have to improve the international cooperation. We have already a good legal matters are concerned. We have a good cooperation as financial matters are concerned. We do not have enough cooperation as far as law enforcement, intelligence, and police cooperation is concerned. So that's what is missing there. And certainly there is a rather long way to go before we could be satisfied with the level of that cooperation.
And what's holding up greater law enforcement, greater police cooperation? Is it kind of a nationalistic impulse? Each country wants to do its own policing, or are there legal impediments? How do you see that?
Well, you know very well that, for instance, in this country, in the United States, you have some legal problems that prevent even national agencies to cooperate with each other, and this is something we have to bear in mind. In general, what happens is that police cooperation or intelligence cooperation touches upon the roots of sovereignty, and nations and countries and governments are still rather reluctant to leave that last parcel of sovereignty out of themselves. And this is something we have to learn. Sovereignty, from that viewpoint, are more and more meaningless, because while we defend or people defend or nations defend their own sovereignty, what happens is that terrorists do not have any respect for those sovereignties. So either we learn the lesson or we are going to be really very, very hardly hit by a terrorist.
But what about your own country, Spain, after the attacks on Madrid last March, 191 dead? Spain will also be concerned about its sovereignty. Did it throw open its doors to law enforcement agents from around the world, from many countries, or was it also trying to do this on its own?
Spain has been developing a very strong bilateral cooperation with the neighboring countries. And as a matter of fact, if we look into what is happening to the Basque terrorists, we can be reasonably satisfied, because the amount of successes that in the last few years the Spanish have done in the fight against Basque terrorism are really significant. The problem is that, that's in many instances due to the bilateral cooperation developed with the French.
And let me ask you, while we have you, Ambassador Paris, do you expect the UN to ever be at the center of this counterterrorism effort, or will it always be on the side?
Well, the United Nations is developing a strong approach to counterterrorism, and I think it's if you look at the speech of the address of the Secretary General of the United Nations precisely in Madrid some months back on the commemoration of the first anniversary of the killings of the 11th of March, you would realize that there is a very robust and very strong approach to counterterrorism. So that's something relatively new as far as the United Nations is concerned. Many people within the United Nations thought that the organization was only fit for peacekeeping operations or for human rights or for development and the policy, and now they've become conscious of the fact that the United Nations could play a very significant role. Well, we don't have police in the United Nations. We don't have intelligence agencies within the United Nations. We don't have armies. What we can do and are doing is to promote a very strong feeling of international cooperation through all those fields, because after all, the intelligence services are in the nations, in the government.
Mm-hmm.
The same applies to the armies, and the same applies to the police. And at the same time, we are setting the legal framework under which that cooperation could take place, and encouraging the countries to follow that international cooperation. With one thing which is at the same time extremely important is that the United Nations is the only organization which can give proper international authority and legitimacy to all those actions.
So you say, but of course we've seen that disputed at different points, but we're happy for your perspective tonight. Ambassador Ruperes, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for calling.
Ambassador Javier Ruperes, Executive Director of the UN's Counterterrorism Executive Directorate and former Spanish Ambassador to the United States. Dustin is calling from Waukegan, Illinois. Hi, Dustin, you're on the air. What do you think? What do you see?
Hi, thank you, and thanks for having me on the air.
Sure.
I think that the multinational counterterrorism efforts are actually going pretty well, and I'll tell you why I think that.
Yeah.
As horrible as the terrorist efforts have been in London and Madrid in recent months, they've been, as far as all reports can tell, they've been limited to conventional explosives. I think that, you know, the worst case scenario is where aerosolized chemical or biological agents,
right,
and ultimately nuclear agents that could be used have not been used, and I think that's a sign that at least at some level that the multinational groups are saying that we will, you know, we have a zero tolerance policy for at least state sponsored terrorism, and hopefully in getting these smaller groups from getting these weapons of mass destruction. I'd like your guests to comment on that if they could.
We've got it, Dustin. Thanks for your call. 50 dead, 700 wounded, but a sense there, almost perversely, and yet we understand it, Julianne Smith, that this could have been a lot worse. Do you take the scale of the attack? How do you look at this, the kind of ratio between the fact of the attack and the scale of the attack? Do you find it encouraging or discouraging in terms of the global success of policing efforts here?
Well, I think Dustin's right. I mean, this could have been a lot worse than it actually was. It was tragic and horrific in many ways and regretful. But in any case, we have been imagining a catastrophic attack in a major European or perhaps American city since September 11th with the use of perhaps a weapon of mass destruction. And so compare it to what we've been imagining in our heads since September 11th as future possibilities. This was very simple. It was highly coordinated, but yes, they're relying on strictly conventional means. This was not a bioterrorism, chemical attack in any way, shape, or form. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't think about that as a possible scenario in the future, and I would hope that this would also trigger increased cooperation in the area of nonproliferation. I personally feel like we are not doing enough in this area as partners, and I'd like to see Europeans and Americans come together in a greater way to address this challenge. But it's a very good point, and Yes, 50 dead is 50 too many, but certainly it could have been 500 or 5,000.
David Aaron, help us understand how this works. In terms of global cooperation, is there somewhere, anywhere on this planet, a big, you know, the equivalent of a big whiteboard where it's all mapped out, what we know, what we don't know, the question marks and filling, you know, checking off the boxes? Or is there a shared database? Is there the equivalent of that? Or is it each nation pursuing and holding its own data and sharing little bits here and there? What's it look like?
Well, it's more like the latter, I'm sorry to say. What's happened is this. For example, in Europe, they don't trust each other. It isn't that they don't – I don't think it's a question of sovereignty. I really don't think that's the root problem. The root problem is security.
So they don't trust the others not to leak what they've learned, for example?
Yes, or that they are penetrated in some way by – By Al-Qaeda?
Seriously?
Or jihadists. Of course. And so there's what's happened here is that in some ways the United States has become the big chalkboard because we have bilateral relations with all these countries.
I see, yeah.
We control what we send them. They control what they send us. But typically they're a lot more open with us than they are sometimes with one another.
So a kind of hub and spoke relationship for the data flow there.
It's really very much like that. Now, in Europe, some key countries do have, relationships as well. But there is no multilateral way to do this. It's not NATO. The European Union hasn't organized them. And, of course, if you look to the rest of the world, there is no international security structure that would even be a candidate for this.
But what about Interpol? For decades, we heard about how effective that was, not in the terrorist cooperation front?
Well, it does help when you're if you want to know the criminal, if there's a criminal background to a particular suspect. But they've also tried to create a Europol, which would help just the Europeans get together. And it's very, very difficult. It's not a very good organization. The one thing the Europeans have been able to do that I think was very good is that they're able to, if one country puts out an arrest warrant, another country is now in Europe obligated to execute it. Well, you would have thought that was more or less automatic.
Seems like a minimal step.
Okay. Yeah, this is a big triumph.
So it's step by step. Let's take another call. Andrew is calling from Boston. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
How do you do?
Very well, thanks.
I'm just interested to hear David Aaron speaking on his last point.
Yes.
The intelligence services of Europe, as he's just said, are suspicious of each other, but then equally they're suspicious of the United States. And they feel the CIA is not actually... Well, they all joke about each other's competence. But one great difficulty is the U.S. has never had a security service, and now it's running about trying to say that it knows all this.
Never had a security service. We've got the FBI, the CIA, and a million other acronyms.
Security service. The FBI is a police operation.
Yes.
So you don't have an internal security service such as Britain or France or Holland.
Like MI6 in Europe, that sort of thing.
Five is what we call the British one. The French have their own thing, and so do the Germans. One of the difficulties that they have is pure information sharing to such a volume, and nobody's ever really been able to work out how to sort through the volume of information. If you're collecting information, I'm sure Mr. Aaron knows, it's just a pile of stuff which somebody has to go through and collate. And when you're sharing that with other countries, whether you trust them or not, it's an immensely time-consuming operation.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, let us pick that up. Our time is short before the break here. David Aaron, what about that? Just within the United States, the NSA and others have so much data. When it gets to that huge level that we can only imagine globally, is there any central computer through which it could be run, is run?
Well, it's frankly, it's one of the things we at RAND are working on, which is how do you collate all this tremendous amount of information? We've made a lot of progress over the years in being able to do that because we do collect a vast amount of information, and typically we share that information with the British and the Australians and to some extent the Canadians. But beyond that, that kind of information is doled out.
Doled out and therefore sort of molecular, not necessarily knit together.
That's correct. Unless they were, for example, if we were working with the French on a particular project and a particular problem that had come up, we would probably share with them almost everything we had unless the sources were so sensitive and significant that we couldn't do so.
David Aaron, Julianne Smith, please stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking tonight about tracking down the terrorists. What do you think? Can we arrest Islamist terrorists first fast enough to keep up with the speed of their creation? And what will it take to break down all barriers to a truly internationally integrated anti-terror effort? Do you want to see that happen? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about tracking down the terrorists, about what's working, what's not, and the successes and failures of global cooperation. You can join us. What will it take to break down all the barriers to a truly integrated anti-terror effort? How are we doing in this fight? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight from Washington by Julianne Smith at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, from California by David Aaron at RAND's Center for Middle East Public Policy, and right now from Rowlett, Texas, by Buck Revell. He's a 30-year FBI veteran, former associate deputy director of the FBI, in charge of counterterrorism and counterintelligence activities. He retired in 1994, but has stayed involved in international security consulting. Buck Revell, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Glad to be with you, Tom.
So, as much as you can, at the kind of granular level, to the extent you're keeping up with it, how do you see what's really working here? What's not? What's the sand in the gears of doing even better on counterterrorism activity? Where's the front?
Well, the front is global in this war, and it probably will be so for the foreseeable future. There is a great deal of sharing that has gone on before 9/11, and it has been enhanced and improved. There were certain organizations that existed, Interpol to a certain extent, but it had substantial limitations, and you couldn't share sensitive data because there were many terrorist-sponsoring nations that are a part of Interpol. Mm. The groups are, for instance, with the Europeans, we had the Trevi Group, and the Trevi Group, heads of the National Police Services, the Attorneys General and Ministers of Justice, mm-hmm. and the Chief Operating Officers of the agencies, we got together twice a year, and we went through policy-level issues and made decisions on the sharing of information, and through the legal attaché system and through where there weren't legal attachés, through the regional security officers and, of course, intelligence information through the station chiefs was shared, and this is before 9/11, on a rather active basis. A number of joint investigations were carried out rather seamlessly, but there were restrictions in the law with what we could share, even within the United States, both the FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the Privacy Act, the Grand Jury Secrecy under Rule 6E, the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, the Attorney General Guidelines. There were a number of limitations on sharing information, even domestically, much less, you know, sharing it internationally. And many, but not all of those, have been adjusted or revoked in the Patriot Act process.
Buck Revell, take us, if you would, to the as close as you can to the street or desert or mountain level. I'm not sure what to call it here tonight. What's your sense of the fronts on which the rubber's meeting the road in terms of actually tracking down terrorists? I mean, at some point, somebody has to tap them on the shoulder or, you know, walk into a room. Where's that happening? How's it happening?
Well, it's happening various ways. There are arrests being made and renditions occurring in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Obviously, there is tracking of terrorist groups that are not indigenous to Iraq, that is ongoing in Iraq. there's not only military operations and intelligence operations, there are law enforcement operations ongoing in each of those areas, which includes the full range of law enforcement activities from forensic investigations, interviews, crime scenes, and so forth, as well as the traditional sharing of intelligence that is gained through other means, such as sources and technical means.
But is it individual agents? Is it sort of cowboys in the field? Is it immigration officials at border points?
No, not. Well, I can't speak for all the agencies. Mm. I do know what the FBI is doing, and it has a regular command structure in country. It's dealing, obviously with the ambassador and with the State Department, but it's dealing with the military commands and with the indigenous groups that are being formed up. It's helping train the police in Iraq and as well as in Afghanistan. And it is bringing their people here for training. And it is attempting to create a law enforcement capability and a security service capability that will obviously be to our benefit, but also to eventually allow these countries to maintain their security on an independent basis.
Julianne Smith, if you could look with us for a moment at the kind of spectrum between from counterinsurgency to counterterrorism. The military involved more on the counterinsurgency, but also at this point they're sort of intermingled. I mean, is there a seamless effort here? Is there a handoff point between the military and policing, security agencies? How does that work?
Well, I think that's been part of the challenge in combating terrorism over the last couple of years, and you can go back as far as a couple of decades. There are difficulties in linking, obviously, military operations to handoffs to counterinsurgencies. We've seen that, obviously, with Iraq. You can talk to any of the folks on the ground and hear some of the stories there about the challenges of working together as a unit. I mean, there's so many moving parts in this.
What do you mean by that last piece? Give us a story, if there are so many. I don't really understand what you mean.
There's so many different hurdles. We're looking at problems of capabilities, whether or not governments that we're working with in a coalition of the willing that exists, for example, in Iraq, whether or not they have the right capabilities, both from a military perspective, mm-hmm. from a paramilitary perspective, from a policing, from an intelligence. There are just dozens of different components. And so there are capability issues. Mm-hmm. There are resource issues, whether or not we're putting the resources in the right places. There's also a threat perception level, whether or not a country determines to put a certain amount of resources into capability X, mm-hmm. say expeditionary forces versus paramilitary forces versus some sort of counterinsurgency strategy, depends very much on how that country is looking at the threat. And let's be honest, not all of the European countries we're dealing with, not the United States and Canada, we can't all sit together in a room and say we're looking at this exactly in the same light. That is simply not the case.
You mean different levels of urgency?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are countries that see it very much as we do. I think the UK and France, to a certain extent, work with us very closely on many of these levels that I just mentioned. But there are certainly other countries out there that are skeptical about some of the assessments that we provide to them and some of the information that they're receiving.
Countries that don't perceive that they are themselves at risk? And who are we talking about? Are we talking about Italy here?
I mean, what's interesting about what happened yesterday is we can finally refute the argument mm-hmm. that terrorists are ultimately coming after the United States. Now Europeans, particularly after 3/11 and what we saw yesterday in London, have to recognize that the threat also is facing them. And there have been European countries who view the threat very much as something that's targeted at U.S. interests or the United States specifically.
3/11 being Madrid and Spain last year, but can't they still sit back and say, well, Spain had troops in Iraq, the U.K. is the United States' closest ally here, it's still an American circle target.
Yeah, they could say that, but let's also recognize that there have been about 15 to 20 thwarted attacks throughout Europe, and that includes strategies and attacks that we've stumbled on in a country like France, who happens not to be with us in Iraq. Mm. And if I had to guess, I would say that we are going to see future terrorist attacks on European soil, most certainly in countries that are not participating with us in the war in Iraq.
Buck Revelle, you can turn on the TV in America tonight and hear that Zarqawi in Iraq is the mastermind of the attack in London. Does that ring true to you, or does that sound like ghost stories?
Well, it could be pure fiction, but we do know that bin Laden, in fact, tasked al-Zarqawi to carry out actions outside of the Iraqi theater, that that he urged them to expand their operations outside of Iraq and certainly take the battle to the United States and its allies. So I don't know whether that is factual or not, but it certainly is feasible.
Let's get another call here. Lee's calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Lee. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hi. Thanks for the interesting discussion. My question is, you guys are making the reasonable assumption that more cooperation is good, but I'm wondering if that might not always be the case. For example, if you have more fragmentation, to some extent competition between the different intelligence services, then they're also more likely to develop more sources and types of intelligence than they would otherwise. For example, I understand one of the explanations for why the global intelligence on Iraq wasn't better was that a lot of countries were basically relying on what the CIA said, and we were in turn relying on what the UN survey group said.
So kind of a single source looping back on itself.
Right. So kind of you run the risk of getting a lot of free riders, and like you just said, it kind of turns into a one-way conversation.
Lee, let us pick that up. David Aaron, how about it? Is there a point at which you don't want to cooperate too much because everyone's singing out of the same hymn book and doesn't look up?
Well, I think the areas where you don't want to necessarily feel that you can cooperate or permit a veto, for example, is when you see a target that is very important to the United States and you have to go after it. But when it comes to the issue of, for example, human collection, I think that you just have competition.
What does human collection mean? You mean intelligence collection? I see.
Spies,
yes. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And countries aren't going to give up that particular prerogative. They may be better or worse at it, but I think that competition exists. Insofar as it exists, it's also a problem because you find sometimes that one particular agent is actually working for two or three different intelligence services, and so you think you're getting confirmation from other intelligence services, but in fact you're just hearing the same guy.
Julianne Smith, when we got into this, sadly, 3 going on 4 years ago now, one of the main themes we heard was that infiltration was going to be incredibly difficult. There were so few Arabic-speaking Americans to begin with, not to mention in other countries, and Al-Qaeda was so simultaneously kind of tight-knit and modular that it would be near impossible to infiltrate. You talked about the number of arrests that have been made. Is that as a result of infiltration? Is infiltration happening, or is this all about, predators looking down from above, guys parachuting in, helicopters landing, and all that?
Well, certainly infiltration is a component of that and part of the success story in our ability to capture and kill many of the al-Qaeda operatives that we're after. But it is a challenge, both for the United States and many countries inside Europe. One country that I would point out, though, I think the Brits have done a very good job in this area. They've developed some very interesting programs over the years. They have specially trained often minority police officers who have the language skills and the cultural understanding to go into these communities.
You're talking about their domestic communities in
the
UK, two million Muslims just to start with, not to say Muslims are the only community of interest here, I guess.
No, but certainly this is a community that is watched closely in many countries throughout Europe and others here in the United States and Canada to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. But the Brits have developed this innovative program. I mean, they're relying on people with the necessary cultural understanding and the language skills to go in, slowly gain credibility in these communities and enter them and obviously get what they can.
Can they apply that in Peshawar? Can they apply that along the Afghan border? Does it work there or just at home?
Of course. I mean, there are many different layers of this. I'm just specifically talking about what's going on inside British soil. But this is certainly something that's undertaken by multiple countries to the extent that we can, although I think it's quite clear in some of the studies that have come out, particularly the 9/11 Commission report, that points to our deficiencies in this area. And the sad fact of the matter is it's going to take us several years, if not decades, to build up our capabilities in this area.
Sultan is calling from Salem, New Hampshire. Hi, Sultan. You're on the air.
How are you?
Very well.
I have a lot in my chest. Please give me a little minute.
Yes, please. Let's hear.
I think the whole discussion is the same mold that we've been on and on week after week, month after month, military action, police action, spying, infiltration. But, when we have divided the world into like such a sharp line, us and them. Mm-hmm. You know, we the first word, they're the third word. We mm-hmm. love ideology, life, and they hate ideology and all that.
Good and evil.
You know, good and evil and all that. And then on other side, that saying that we are more moral than these Western infidels, and you know we are on the right path and they're on the wrong path.
The Muslims saying the Muslim extremists saying they're more moral than the corrupt Westerners.
So
yes,
it's becoming like a divide. You know, more much more pronounced every day now. And then the discussion like you have now, everybody, oh yeah, let's buy more, let's more, mm-hmm. and like the Gitmos, you know, put more people in jail and all that. But, you know, how are we going to, you know, resolve this cycle, you know, when we have more responsibility in the sense that we are the most powerful, we are the rich, we can do things.
So, Sultan, let me ask you, I hear exactly where you're going, I'm sure our listeners do. Can I assume that you're Muslim?
Yeah, and I have three suggestions after this, you know. I think, why don't you have something like a G8 level meeting of
yes.
religious people, you know, of them and us, you know.
I think it's a great idea, but you began by saying you got a lot on your chest, and I can only imagine, I mean, and you're in the U.S., imagine if you're a Muslim in the U.K. tonight. It's got to feel horrible, but what you, and we've talked also many nights about the kind of issues you're raising, but what are security forces supposed to do when the threat is acute? You know, the bodies are still in the subway tunnels. We have to think in terms of policing, don't we?
I'm not denying that. But mm-hmm. on the other side is saying, like last week, Afghanistan, we bombed the place, killed 16. That even didn't
16
make
civilians, innocent
yeah.
civilians, as the U.S. said, yes.
Yeah, that didn't even make the news. So
well, it did. But
when the value of life is so different from one to the other, you know, then I don't know where to go. We've been living, my kids have never seen a program mm-hmm. on a TV mm-hmm. which showing a good side of Islam. It's always terrorism side. You know, they have never seen anything saying good about this.
Buck, I couldn't agree more. We can hear it in everything we hear tonight. It's not going to be settled just by going sword tip to sword tip. And I thank you for calling, Sultan. Buck Gravel, how about that? I mean, this all happens in a context. There's police work to be done. But can it ever be solved unless the kind of division that the Sultan is pointing out somehow ameliorated?
Well, I hear that, and I spend a lot of time in the Middle East, and I have many, many Muslim business associates, and, mm-hmm. and some of them are very close friends, and they're worried about this. And I think we have to keep our eye on those that are committing and facilitating the commission of these terrorist acts rather than the ethnic group or the religious group that they come from. It's very difficult to do because they cloak themselves in their religion, and that makes it more difficult to differentiate between, you know, the Muslims who are moderate and mainstream and deplore what is happening and those that are preaching violence and recruiting, you know, young people to become associated with the violence. But I would point out to Sultan that it beginning in 1979 with the Ayatollah Khomeini's return to Iran, when he declared war on the United States and called us the great Satan, and they created Hezbollah, it has been the militant Islamic organizations, the jihadists, that have brought the war to us, not vice versa. So I do think that the moderate Islamic community, needs to speak up and assert itself and differentiate itself from those who are advocating jihad against the Western nations. And we need, in turn, to recognize that it's not monolithic and that, in fact, there are Muslims who deplore this as much as we do, and that they are in the majority.
A critical message tonight. With that, we're out of time. Buck Gravel, 30-year veteran of the FBI, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
You're very welcome.
Julianne Smith in Washington at the CSIS, thank you for joining us, Ms. Smith.
Thank you.
And David Aaron joining us tonight from Santa Monica at RAND, Center for Middle East Public Policy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.